League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hello, we're back. We made it. Season two. Who would have thought, eh? We got past season one. No, really, warm welcome to everybody who's joining us for the Round Golf Podcast. Some of you may be for the first time. Where were you? And some of you back for the second series after listening to season one. And if you haven't heard season one, you can go back. They're all in the archive. You won't miss a single thing. And there's some great interviews in there. Now, if you haven't heard this podcast before, basically let's say golfer choose a round. That's how we start the interview, that changed their career, the way that maybe their life unfolded in the world of golf, the one that has most significance for them. And then after that, we kind of go into a biographical interview, which tells you a little bit about their life and how they got there and what happened after the round, that kind of thing. Now, before we get to Padraig, just want to say a big thanks, obviously, first in the series, to our new sponsors, Redway and Navigate Constructing, without whom, of course, this wouldn't all be possible. Now, of course, you know you've clicked on this. First interview is with the newly appointed Ryder Cup captain, Padraig Harrington. Padraig is a great character. He talks fantastically as well, and in depth always to every question asked. In fact, he's probably the first person in any of the series that I've spoken to who's actually come prepared with notes, which will give you a bit of a clue to how he'll tackle being that Ryder Cup captain. I don't think any stone will be left unturned when taking on Team USA on their soil. So without further ado, let's get straight to the interview.
So, Padraig, when I knew I was going to ask you which one the round was going to be for the round that you chosen, I had a feeling it wouldn't be a straightforward, you know, the Open win or winning the USPGA. I knew it might be something a little different.
Yeah, look, I had to have a think about this, and you're trying to find the most pivotal round in your career. I could go and say maybe the most pivotal tournament is the first tournament I ever played. I think it was South Africa, first ever tournament on the tour as a tour member. It was 1996. I played the South African Players' Championship in Durban Country Club, made the cut, finished 46th, won £1,480, I think, in or around that. And it was life-changing for me because I didn't think I'd played that well, but I'd made the cut. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, hey, even without my best game, I can still make a cut, I can still be out here, I belong here. And I constantly come back to this when I'm talking to young pros. The key to being successful as a PGA Tour professional or as a European Tour, as any tour professional, is believing you belong. So that was huge, but as I said, that was a tournament. So we're trying to find a round that was pivotal. For me, I could go to those major championships, and especially my first one, winning the Open in 2007. Last round, I messed up the 72nd hole, so you know that always leaves a little bit of a sour taste. I didn't win it the way you would have dreamt of winning it as a kid. Still very exciting to win, but left a little something wanting. I came back the following year and obviously won in Berkeley, 2008 Open, which that was very satisfying. First one was very exciting. That was very satisfying because I won it like you would have dreamt of winning it as a kid. That last round did come very close because I was in the last group. I was playing with Greg Norman. There was a big story. You know, I was favourite going out there and I played the golf. So I was very close to saying that was the round. It was a great round for me. But the one that I would put down as the pivotal round in my career, the one that I feel drew a line in the sand round, was actually the 2006 US Open at Winged Foot. And a lot of things, strange things, well, not strange things happened, but as I say, I feel it was pivotal. At that stage, I was one of the best players not to have won a major. So I'd be going into these majors, you know, with the, you know, is it going to be your turn? But up to that, bar 2002 Open Championship at Muirfield, that was the only one where I had a chance. I had lots of good finishes. I'd finished well up there in many majors, but I didn't really have a chance of winning them. In Muirfield on the last day, I had a great last day, a great week actually. I needed to par the last to get into a playoff. Now at the time I thought I needed to make birdie. I forced it, made a bogey and missed the playoff. Was very disappointed. I played fantastic that week. And actually we'll talk about when we get to Wingfoot. It was similar to a Wingfoot experience, as in I played fantastic, not a good week on the greens. I played well enough to win, no doubt about it. But when I walked away, I had no reason, I had no understanding why. It was always an outlier to me, what happened that week. I had no understanding why was that such a special week. I didn't have any control over my performance. As good as it was, it wasn't predictable, it wasn't controllable, or at least I felt that at the time. So from 2000 to 2006, I'm obviously looking for this controllability. How do I get that form that was there in 2002? And Wingfoot was it. I had a plan in place, I prepared properly, got myself out there in the tournament on a golf course that, you know, Wingfoot is big, tough, tree-lined, heavy, heavy, rough golf course. You know, you've got to play some great golf tee to green, which wouldn't be my strength normally. I had a plan and prospect, and really much more to do with my preparation, how I came into the tournament. And sure enough, that preparation, it takes 3 weeks for me to get ready for a tournament.
So what are you saying? So week one, what happens then?
Week one is a week off. You go home, look at your game, you work with your coach, you get everything in line that you want to get in line. Week two is a tournament where you go and play. You're shutting things down, but you're getting on top of things. You know, certain things like alignment and stuff like that. You're just making sure you've got a clear idea, but you're definitely shutting down the left side of your brain. You're definitely getting away from your technique and you're getting into playing. So the third week of it, last week before the tournament, you are completely shut down. All you are doing is going out there and playing and scoring on the golf course. You're doing your work off the course, you're still doing your practice, you're still doing your drills, you're doing all that stuff. And then when you get into the tournament, you've gone literally, this would be your third week without working on any technique. You actually just turn up, play. It's a real taper down. The week of a tournament, you do much less than in any other week. You know, less practice, less gym work. You really are there just as if the following Monday doesn't exist. Whereas most tournaments you're playing, you've always got a little eye on what's coming down the road. At a major, there's nothing coming down the road. It just goes to Sunday.
So how long had it been till you got to this process? Was it by this US Open?
This was how it was falling into place around this time. This is what I was seeing as... It basically comes down to it took me a full 2 weeks and then the third week of the tournament to shut my brain down, to be fully in playing mode for me rather than somewhat in half and half.
So then you come to that US Open and you feel now you are in that mindset.
Well, I am. I feel like I've done the preparation right. I feel like this is the way to go. But I still, and this is what we're going to get to, I still haven't got proof that this system works. This is the system I'm trying to play with, and this is how I'm going about. Like, you'll have other players who will take the week off beforehand, and everybody has their own way of doing it. This was somewhat experimental at this stage. This is what I felt would work for me, and I'm going at it. So I pitch up, and I play very nicely the first 3 days, no problem. I'm in good position going into the final round. I'm not like super under pressure. I go out in the final round, I'm 6 over, 2 over par is leading. But, you know, to US Open, you're not far behind. I'm certainly 6th place, something like that, going into the last round, somewhere around that. So I'm well in contention. I think Phil Mickelson and Kenny Ferry are leading.
That's right, yeah.
But I'm doing my job. I'm applying myself. And I get in the first hole, and you know straight away, like literally after a couple of shots, I know I'm in the zone. Now that's, people get in the zone haphazardly over at times. Like in any sport, what you do is you do your preparation and you hope that your preparation leads you to a point that tips you into the zone. A good athlete would do his preparation and most people wouldn't know whether they're in the zone or not. If they've done everything right, they're close, but not, you know, being in the zone, you need something special to be in the zone as well. So you do all your preparation, you get ready, you're right there, and then you probably need, for me certainly, I need pressure. I need the adrenaline, I need the excitement to actually really go into the zone. It's very hard to go into the zone if it means nothing. You can do all the nice stuff you like, but you, well, I know, it does happen too. People obviously have been in the zone on a casual day playing golf.
But has it happened to you?
I'm sure I've been in the zone at times, but it's haphazard. I've done my preparation and I've gone out in the first couple of holes, and you have to play a couple before you realise it. And all of a sudden I realise I am there. Say this is probably the fourth week and it's taken me 4 weeks to get this one round right. And obviously the little bit of pressure, a little bit of adrenaline has pushed me into it. And of course, once you get into it, into the zone, now all of a sudden you're trying to make sure you don't get out of it, which is difficult in itself. Because once you realise you're there, the whole idea then is to run with it and not to overthink it. You're just trying to leave it alone and keep going. So there I am. I'm playing the first, I've literally played the first 12 holes. Yeah, I've never seen golf like it. I actually have seen golf like it. Muirfield in 2002, but I didn't know Muirfield. Now I know. I'm watching myself.
So 2002, you've been a pro 6 years. So you were no rookie then, though.
No, but I played sublime golf at Muirfield. I've had good performances, but I had the ball under control for 4 days at Muirfield. I actually put it like a donkey for the week, which is would be my strength. I've never played golf like this up until Wingfoot. I'm playing the golf and I've prepared to play that golf.
You're conscious of what you're doing.
I am conscious, but it's conscious because I've gone into the subconscious. I am somewhat standing back and aware of what's happening, but I know I've set a roadmap to get me there. Whereas Muirfield in 2002, it just happened. This time I've actually controlled myself and worked into this peaked. I have literally peaked for one round of golf, the final round of 2006 US Open. And I'm out there and it's actually happening.
Ultimately, though, you didn't win, but...
Okay, you got to understand, I have played plenty well in majors, finished fifth, finished fourth, but I didn't have chances of winning. And I know when you're out there, you know how things are going, right? I get up and down here and there and, maybe you have a good Sunday to go from 15th spot to 5th spot, or you chip and put a few holes coming home that keeps you in position or whatever. But all of a sudden, I'm actually hitting the golf ball tee to green, something that I've never had in this final round. Not that I wouldn't have the doubt, but I've none of the interference. I still have the doubt, but I am letting it go. I could probably put every cliche that's possible, every psychology cliche that's possible on this Sunday round of golf. It came to a head in 12. Yeah, I parred the first 11 holes. I've not been in trouble once. This is on the hardest golf course. I'm Sunday, guys are all over the place. I am hitting fairways and greens and hitting it close. I am in no bother whatsoever for 11 holes. And on the 12th hole, I actually then hit it to about par 5. I hit it to 15 feet. And again, miss. I've missed. All I've done for 13 holes is miss putts.
It's a par 70. On that day, only two players broke 70. So you missed a good chance for eagle to go 2 under.
2 under, and I should have been 5-6 under par going into the hole. I'm just not used to what I created chances all day. And the interesting thing, I was getting frustrated, obviously, still somewhat in there. 13, I'm still in the zone, and then 14, I hold this putt over the top of the tier, and all of a sudden now I think I'm one shot off the lead. Yeah, I'm one shot off the lead. I think Phil Mickelson is 3 over, I'm 4 over.
Correct.
But now things are happening great. But I now know I'm right on the edge of it at this stage, but playing unbelievable. So bear in mind, and this is the couple of keys to this, I struggle with hitting fairways and greens. I struggle with being that consistent player, not with scoring, with fairways and greens. Here I am in the final round of the golf of a major and I've got everything I want. I'm hitting fairways and greens with ease, but I've controlled this. It's me, it's not Muirfield. I par 15 again with another chance. I go down 16, I've hit it in the middle of the fairway, and Muirfield, you can't afford to miss any, or sorry, this is Wingfoot, you can't afford to miss any fairway. The rough is so deep, you're chipping out.
You're now tied for the lead, by the way.
Tied for lead.
Did you know you were? Yeah.
Did I know? Maybe not, but I knew I was capable of winning at this stage. I knew I just had to do what I was doing. And it was I hit the fairway on 16 and I pulled my 5 iron, clipped a branch and came down just short left of the green, straightforward, maybe probably 30 feet away from the hole, maybe 40 feet away from the hole, but a straightforward chip and run. out of the rough, and I played the worst chip ever. I chipped it like to 12 feet, 15 feet, because I hadn't had another chip all day. Now, this is the difference between me in normal major. I might have had in a normal major in the final round, I might have had five chips at that stage at that point. So, you know, the 1 and 16 would have been run of the mill.
But throughout your career, that's been...
That's how I would do it. Yeah. Normally, I'd miss a few greens. So when I miss a green on the 69th hole of a major, well, I've missed five already, six already today, and I've got them up and down. So this is just another one. You often see that with players. There's some really solid players who have not won majors because they've been so good at hitting fairways and greens that when they get under pressure right at the end of a major tournament, you're going to miss an extra two greens on the back nine. Nearly always happens. And, you know, if you have no practice at getting up and down, it's a lot harder. Like, I can tell you, if you want to see a kid who's probably not going to become a great professional golfer and certainly not going to have a great short game, is if you're at 13, 14, 15 years of age hitting all the fairways and all the greens, you're never going to have any imagination when it comes to getting up and down. And that was I got caught right there on 16, first chip of the day, and I'm like, it's like I'm startled by it. But I don't get up and down, a bit of a shock, no problem. I stand up in the next hole, I hit a lovely drive down the right-hand side. I actually finished the first cut, but like as good as you'd want. And I've gone with, I think, about a 9-iron. And this is my first mistake of the day. This is my rookie error. I've panicked. I've dropped a shot, I've dropped a 5-over, and I misread the other guys. I think, oh my, I've got to make birdie. And I've hit this 9-iron straight over the pin to a back right pin. I've hit it to like 20 feet, but in the back rough.
Because you were trying to attack.
All I'm thinking about is birdie.
Because we should give it the context then that you end up missing out by two shots.
In the end, I'm going to miss by two. But what happens is I bogey 16. I go for the pin on 17 thinking I've got to get this shot back. I'm thinking 4-over is going to win. And the pin, I was only 20 feet from the hole, and I think I chipped it to 3 feet and missed. But the pin was a shocker there. There was... I know Jeff Ogilvie chipped in for the left-hand side. I think he chipped in for par. And, like, literally, they put it on they put the pin on a six-foot-wide tabletop that the grass had worn off by the time we got there. So there was a lot... Monty birdied it, mind you, but it was a typical US Open pin at 17. I messed it up. I made my bogey. And, like, now I'm gutted. You know, again, I drive it down the middle of 18. I've got 9-iron into the green. So I've done the hard work on 16, 17, 18. If you were trying to make three pars to finish there and somebody said you were going to hit the three tee shots I hit, you'd be odds on that you were able to do it. I've hit 9-iron into the middle of the green. I pulled it, to be honest. I was trying to hit a fade. I probably hit it 30 feet left of the hole. What Monty would have given for that. But I've got a putt to actually get into the playoff, as it turned out, to get back to 5-over, and I run it by 8 feet and miss it. Completely misread this situation, and this is one of the things I would have learned with experience from situations like that and others. I would be better at reading the field, you know, whatever reason. Maybe I thought somebody was gonna, you know, maybe I thought 3-over, but certainly 4-over was the winning score. As we turned out, it was 5-over. That was experience. But the telling point is most people who bogeyed, like had a putt to win on the last and three putter, or bogeyed the last three holes to lose a major, or, you know, made the mistakes I made on those three holes, because there were some, you know, to come in three bogeys from the way I was playing and the way I struck the ball over those last number of holes was bad, and certainly bad for my style of play. But I walked off, and I've come out under the bleachers, and you see we are in America, bleachers, and I come all the way up to the clubhouse, and there's a lovely lawn. There's at least 50 yards of a walk up to the clubhouse where there was, and it's quiet because it's all going on the other side of the bleachers. And I'm walking up, and I'm met by Bob Rotella, who I work with, Bob, as my sports psychologist. And Bob is coming out, you know, to console me. He's coming out to put his arm around me and say, you know, really, you know, I'm sure he's nearly prepared a speech at this stage. And I know Bob has commented on this. He says he was never met with such, he was shocked and surprised to be met by me. I was in such a joyous mood, because that was the moment that I realized I was capable of winning a major myself, by me, within my control, without needing other people. Up to that, I was, you know, I was put in the category, could win a major, one of the best players that hasn't won a major, but I only believed I could win it if other people did things. I only believed I could win it if I got lucky, if it was a special week. Whereas I walked off that golf course believing I could win a major myself within myself by doing my thing. And you know, I clearly didn't need to make the mistakes I made over the last three holes, but from learning from that situation, I knew going forward that, hey, the next time I might make those mistakes, but I knew I was capable of doing it, that I didn't need other people to let me win.
It's funny, because if you look back and read stuff, as I've trying to be doing, to do a little bit of research on the round itself, it's all about Mickelson, it's all about Monty.
Yeah.
You're a side note.
I never got hung out to dry because of what Mickelson did in 18 and what Monty did in 18, but neither of them. It was my major. At least in my head, it was my major. I don't know what they did for the first 71 holes either, and they might look back and say they did mistake. But the fact is, I know that my performance was controllable and predictable. I had a predictable model to get me into the zone on the final day of a major. What a place to be in golf. It was a great feeling to realise that my system worked for me.
It might be a bad link, but I know it's not the first time you've bogeyed the last three holes to miss out. Irish youths when you're 18 years old, I mean, was that also significant as well, but in a different way?
Yeah, well, that's the first time. When I lost the Irish youths, I was 18. I was two ahead with three to play, and you wouldn't have leaderboards as you would expect. And I got word with three holes to play, or with four holes to play, I got word, I think, that I was two ahead. And the 15th hole was a big, tough hole. And when I finished the 15th hole, I made a par. All of a sudden, I'm two ahead with three to play, with easy holes. Sure, I can't lose from there. And of course, I relaxed. And strangely enough, I lost. I bogeyed the last three holes. And kids, as we were kids at the time, I'm sure we didn't think we were, are quite harsh. And I was, you know, the people made it known that they thought I choked and I was a choker, and I shed a few tears and all that. And I actually started working with a psychologist afterwards because of that. Aidan Moran, who's out of UCD in Dublin, and started working on it. And to my delight and relief, I found out that I actually had done the opposite of choking. I relaxed. I thought I had it won and relaxed. And that served me well over the years. I do not play well in a relaxed environment. I don't play well when I have a lot of options, when things... I'm a much better player with my back to the wall, with a bit of stress, and it just brings clarity and focus to me.
People would have seen that as well when you won the Open itself in 2007. You were under a lot of stress after what happened going down that 18th, and you reacted in a very clear mind. That up and down has to go down as one of the great up and downs to make a six.
Well, what was really strange about that is I played very well at the Open first three rounds, but again, I've gone out on the Sunday, like 2006, and I know I'm in the zone. And I've just stayed in it and kept there and just minded it. You have to mind yourself when you're in the zone. And I've played beautifully all day. I could have been three or four shots better, easily. You know, I've hit it close, I've had chances. Fantastic day. I've come to the 18th hole, I have a one-shot lead, and I'm confident. And sometimes when I'm overconfident, it opens my mind a little bit too much. So I stand up on that tee and I'm just gonna bust it down the middle. Things are great, right to left wind, fantastic, no problem. Not a fear in my mind. And I stand up there and, you know, clear, I get to the top of my backswing and a small bit of doubt. And a small bit of doubt when you're not expecting it can manifest itself in a massive reaction. And I just went, don't hit it left, don't hit it right, don't hit it left, oh, miles right. And it really was an ugly tee shot. And I followed it with a very difficult shot that was not great. Well, after a penalty drop, so the third shot was pretty bad too, but it was more situational, the third shot. And I thought I'd lost the Open. And what's worse is, I've never felt this. I felt embarrassed. I felt I'd choked. I wanted to give up.
Because it could have been like a Jean Van de Velde moment, couldn't it?
Oh, well, I couldn't care less about Jean Van de Velde at the moment. It was me.
Yes.
That's all you're in the moment. It was my chance to win. We go back to 2006. I could handle that because that was my first time. I prepared. 2007 was okay. This is the time. You've learned your lesson. Here you go. This is your one to win. You got there. You're in position. And there's a huge sense as well, it's mine to win. You know, maybe you could go back to 2006 and say, well, there was other people in it. I'm one shot ahead playing the last. It's mine to win. And I've messed it up. And luckily, I wanted the ground to swallow me up. I just wanted to get, and I've never ever wanted to give up on the golf course. And my caddy, we'd worked with Bob Botella and my caddy stuck to the cliches. And he, you know, I'd say for 50 yards, he hit me with every cliche he knew. You know, it's not over, one shot at a time, let's play it out. And I'm sure he took the club off me because I would have hit him with it. But he just was relentless. He just kept at it. And, you know, for the next 50 yards, I believed it. And this is a really, really strange thing. It was only another 50 yards before I was taking my drop. I actually went from in the zone, out of the zone, back into the zone. And I hit hit a chip shot in the last hole, 48 yards. And I hit the chip shot like I was 15 years of age, showing off to my friends at home. I flew it in there low and hard with loads of spin. Exactly what a kid, you know, when you're messing with your friends, you see how much spin you can get in a shot. And like, it's flying in there. It's really spinning hard, flying low. The whole crowd think I've knifed it over the green. They're all going ooh and ah and think this thing has gone 30, 40 feet by. And in my head, I'm jumping up and down. Watch it spin, watch it spin. Exactly like a teenager showing off to his friends. That's how much, and that's what being in the zone is. That's how much I was there and then. And you know, clearly it did spin up. It finished about 6 feet behind the hole. I knocked the putt in. I won't say I knocked the putt in with the same childish enthusiasm. I just, that was willpower that got it in the hole. But yeah, that Sunday was the absolute replica of 2006. The 3 weeks coming into it was the replica of 2006. The only difference is I learned everything in 2006 and I knew I was capable of winning a major based on that one round of golf.
I've heard, I don't know if this is true or not, on the Saturday night before the final round of the Open 2007, you're telling everybody, even though you're six shots behind, I'm going to win the Open.
There was an element of that week. I told anybody, you know, you get asked all the time. You get asked all the time, how are you going to do, whether it's the guy looking for, you know, I don't know what he's looking for, the punter out in the street, if he's looking for a glint in your eye so he runs down and backs you. I just told everybody I was going to win that week. It was a bit, you know, let's see whether being positive and being, instead of being, I would normally be the type of guy that would try not get into it, let alone play it down. I would just try and keep away from that sort of stuff. So I was having a bit of fun with it. But yes, I told everybody who would listen to me I was going to win. I was trying to be positive. And I kept telling myself, and this is a more of a practical stage. So when Sergio came down the last, he had about an 8-10 footer to win the tournament. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting in the recorder's hut watching on the TV, sound turned down because I didn't want to listen to the commentary about what I did in 18. And obviously I'm aware that I need him to miss in order for me to win. But I sat there and never wished for him to miss. So I didn't go miss. I went, I'm going to win. I'm going to win the Open. I'm going to win this. So that when he did miss, my emotions never went up or down. They were still, I'm going to win. And I think problem people have, and I'm sorry we're getting into a practical psychology lesson here.
I'm enjoying it.
If you have goals and you set conditions, I'm going to win is a good example, I'm going to win. People tend to say how they're going to win. So if I said I'm going to win this playoff, as in 2000, I'm going out to win. If I said I'm going to win the playoff, and then as we do, we tend to daydream and go, well, I'm going to birdie the first. I'm going to hit it down the middle of the first. I'm going to hit it on the green and hold the putt. And I'm going to birdie the second. And I'm going to wave at the crowds. Well, if you set those sort of conditions, the minute you fail to live up to them, it's telling your mind, okay, I've birdied the first, I win. Well, if I par the first, your mind goes, oh, you par the first, or you can't win. You've just said you needed to birdie it. So a lot of times when people set goals, and this is why people struggle with goal setting and things, they put conditions on it, and the conditions can then, if the conditions don't happen, clearly then they believe the goal can't happen. But the fact is, I could win a four-hole playoff by double bogey in the first hole. There is no condition. I just was going to win, and that put me in a very solid frame of mind mentally, that there wasn't the highs and lows. When Sergio missed, when I walked in the tee, most people would say they could see it in my eyes I was going to win. I don't believe in that. You could see in my eyes I was focused, but the big part of me was I wasn't putting myself under pressure to do it in any particular way. So I think that's huge when you're, you know, I can't say telling people you're going to win is the key to winning tournaments, but certainly believing you're going to win, but understanding you can win a tournament by hitting it out of bounds. You can win a tournament by bogeying the first hole. You can win a tournament by...
by making a double bogey six at the 72nd.
Yeah, I tell you, there's no 15-year-old kid at home dreaming about winning an Open Championship thinking they're going to double bogey the 72nd hole. But it can happen. And I think we all get drawn into that, and even I do now, where my game is much more on the edge now. Well, at least I feel like that. I shouldn't, but, you know, I feel I've got to play great to win. When you are winning, you actually feel like you can just play okay to win. It's a terrible thing in sport. You play much better when you feel that your B game is capable. Remember, Tiger used to come out with the B games, and that makes you turn up with your A game so many more times when you feel like your B game is good enough. When you feel like you need your A game to compete, your B game is more likely to turn up.
It's interesting, because there was that moment of, I'm going to win. There's what happened at Wingfoot. Is also Michael Campbell and his win at the US Open of any significance?
Oh, that was huge for me. I played a lot of practice rounds with Michael Campbell and played a lot of competitive golf. We would have been, you know, a lot of times paired together, and I knew his game, and we'd play a lot of practice rounds. We'd play for, you know, we'd have a bet out in the course or whatever, play for some money, and I'd beat him, he'd beat me. His win made winning a major tangible to me. When you look at Tiger Woods winning a major, so much of that is put up in a pedestal. So much of it is like, you don't really know what's going on or how he's, what he's capable of, and you tend to overestimate what, when you don't know somebody, you tend to think they're better than you than they actually are. I knew Michael Campbell. I knew what he was capable of. I knew how good he was. Michael was one of probably the best mentally when he was good, and actually one of the worst when he was bad. If you put a technical thought in Michael Campbell, his game drops 50%, and if he had no technical thoughts, he was unbelievable. The difference, because he had a few highs and lows in his career, the difference in Michael's game when he was on form, it was beautiful to watch. And when he wasn't on form, he actually went the opposite. There was no in the middle for him. But the main thing was, I knew him. It was very easy to understand what it took to win a major once you know a player well enough. And I think for myself, I know other players have come and said that to me in Europe. When you go back to the 80s, you know, Seve made it possible for, Bernard and Woozy to win, and Ollie to win majors, and Sandy Lyle to win majors, because they were playing with Seve week in, week out, and they knew if their game was at their best, they could compete with Seve. When I won in 2007, 2008, other players would have looked at it and said, well, I know what Harrington plays like. You know, if I play well, I can compete with that. It wasn't... when you know somebody, it's not as magical. You know, when you put Tiger out there on a pedestal and you think he's never hit a bad shot and all that, then it's hard to live up to that standard. It's much easier to live up to a standard that you are familiar with.
So many different places I could go with you next, Patrick. And you talk brilliantly about everything that's happened. It's difficult to know, as I say, which way to go. I want to talk about people that have been important in where you're getting. So Michael Campbell's win, we're saying, was important. If we go back, your dad, policeman in the Garda, Gaelic footballer, professional sportsman as such.
Oh, well, Gaelic football is far from professional sport, but he was one of the best at his sport in the country.
Well, when you say it wasn't professional, as in it wasn't a paid job, but...
No, but there it is revered. It is the top sport in Ireland.
And thousands would go and watch.
Oh, it's a full... yeah. You're a hero in your county and locality, no doubt about it, and... yeah, the matches are sold out.
So being the son of someone as revered as
pretty,
that.
Yeah, and the people I would have met going around Ireland, I was Paddy Harrington's son. My mother always jokes that she eventually went from being Paddy Harrington's wife to Porter Harrington's mother. She never had her own identity, but you know, for a long, long time, pretty much all of my amateur career, I would have been known as Paddy Harrington's son, for sure. He was a beautiful footballer. He lost two All-Ireland finals, which, strangely for my dad, I would have known him as being competitive. He was a very competitive golfer and you know, whatever you put him at. But he'd no regrets about losing two All-Ireland finals. So that'd be similar to losing two FA Cup finals over here or two Super Bowls in the States. It's a big deal in Ireland, but he didn't bother him, which is strange. So I often think...
How do you know it didn't bother him?
Well, he was my dad. I talked to him about it, and it just didn't... My dad was a guard. He was a terrible guard. I don't think the man ever arrested anybody in his life. He gave more drunks money to go home in the bus, and but my dad would have wanted to be the opportunity back in the 50s wouldn't have been this. He would have loved to be a sports psychologist or a coach or any of the involved in sport. He loved sport, and he recognized, I'm sure not at the time, but pretty clearly afterwards, one of their games, like they're playing on the weekend, and they had one big last training session on the Friday afternoon. Like, madness, how stupid is that? But at the time, it was thought, well, we work harder, we win. And of course, they had 27 wides that weekend. So, my dad would have been aware of that, and he would have brought that. I would have grown up with that as a kid, that my dad would have the foresight to see different things happening, whether it was golf or other sports we play. He'd be able to read the situation and understand it a little bit better than just plain results. So I think certainly in our house, we would have thought through a few things and given it a deeper, a bigger picture than just plain score lines.
So he obviously had a big impact. Caroline, your wife, you met kind of like childhood sweethearts. I mean, you look at some relationships in golf, Jack and Barbara and Arnold and Winnie, and you and Caroline, she's been there with you every step of the way in your professional career, hasn't she?
Yeah, it's coming up now on 30 years. I'm only 47.
I remember, for example,
29 years it is now.
In Germany, 1999, for example, you just qualified by finishing second in an event in Germany.
That's right, yeah.
And I looked to my side, and you were sharing a personal moment, obviously, out in the open that I watched. And you could see that closeness and what it meant to the both of you at that time for you to qualify for your first Ryder Cup. You must have had that through various milestones.
Yeah, all the way through. I had very good involvement of family when I was an amateur golfer. So I had two brothers who caddied for me, one in the UK, one in Ireland. Basically, all my big tournaments. My dad caddied, my wife even. Caroline caddied. She wasn't, obviously, at that stage, my wife. So I always had good family around me. My in-laws travelled. There was a good atmosphere. And when I turned pro, pretty quickly after a few good months on the tour, my wife gave up her job and travelled full-time with me. And at one stage, she used to have a nickname on tour of CFAX. We remember the good old days of CFAX.
I do, yes.
Because Caroline would know every stat that was there on tour. So you had players coming to Caroline and asking her what they needed to do world ranking wise to qualify, so whether they should sit out an event and that would get them in, or whether they should play. She would know, she would study it all, and because, well, she obviously had time in her hand, but she was interested. She's very into her competitive. Caroline's probably, she's at least as competitive as I am, so she was into her sport and that. And when I hold that winning putt in, not the winning putt, I hold a great putt, an 8-footer on the last green at BMW in Germany to get into the Ryder Cup. It was a big moment, yeah. We had a lot of big moments as we went along in golf, and she was there to share them all. But so was most of my family. We thankfully, I have a good, solid relationship there. I think sometimes we often see the sport generally touts the genius who, from the age of one, before they can start walking, is a superstar soccer player, and sometimes the relationship with their parents can be lost through all the pressure and stress. It doesn't have to be that way. It's not always the case. I know there are some very special sports people who have gone that route, but in general,
well, we know. I mean, we don't need to name names. I mean, there's an obvious one in golf, isn't there? That's had
not just golf, but I'm thinking all sports.
Sure.
But the majority of people who succeed in sport have actually a more reasonable, balanced way of going about it. But the limelight would tend to go. Like, I don't think you can't find a video of me. We're just talking of playing golf before I'm 17 years of age, 16, 17 years. I never saw my swing on video until I was 16 years of age. And no, 15 was the first time I ever got a lesson. I saw my swing, and God, was I disgusted. I had a great, you have a great visual of your own swing, and when you see it on video, it's a disappointment. It's kind of like listening to your voice. I can tell you, my voice doesn't sound like you're hearing it.
But you've always been quite self-deprecating, really. I mean, I've seen that when you were number 14 in the world, you never believed you were still one of the top-ranked players. You didn't think you were good enough necessarily to turn pro. I mean, when you got to the point where you won those three majors in 6 years and you were only third in the world to Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods, surely you must have thought by then, okay.
Oh, I believed I belonged. That's why I won them. This round, 2006, as I said, in Wingfoot, gave me that belief. I knew I had a system that worked. I believed I belonged at that stage, no doubt about it. There is a lot of part of my career where I nearly had to do it twice before I believed that I was good enough. So sometimes when I got to a position like 14th in the world, I drift back away from it. And it was only when I got there the next time that I go, okay, I'm good enough for this. So I think with all players, we're a strange mix of different things. No doubt for me, I was motivated by fear quite a bit, a healthy fear at times.
Scared of what?
Scared of it all going away. Genuinely scared of it all disappearing, that, you know, tomorrow I wake up and it's not there. I don't have that fear nowadays, which is a shame.
Is that why you sometimes would get up in the middle of the night and go and hit balls in the nets?
Maybe not that fear. That's more of a driven sense because of that video when I was 15. I still don't like my golf swing. It's because of something I don't have. But the fear of losing, yeah, it probably pushed me. You would say that. It pushes me along, like, for many a year, especially that winter break. You know, when a new year starts, you're really scared that, oh, was this all, you know, was somebody going to take it away from me? Were they all having a laugh and it wasn't actually true? Is it going to be there? Yeah, that's for sure. Now, as you get older and with experience, you wish you had those nerves, those butterflies, because, as I said, the first thing you always got to realise about nerves and fear is it sharpens the focus. It really does. There's been I know fear is not a great emotion and it needs to be managed, but there's been a lot of very successful sports people who have operated on with fear as a motivating factor, and that fear drives them on, that they need it, that maybe they have to feed their family, maybe they have to, you know, that it's like with me, it wasn't that, but it was more, you know, that is this going to last? Do I belong? You know, that sort of thing kept me going, kept me getting up. And I still love to practice and do that. But I probably do the practice now more out of curiosity than I would have done it back in the day, which I did it out of, you know, I need to be right on top of things if I want to be out here.
Just before I move on to a couple of other people, back to Caroline. With all that a Ryder Cup captaincy entails, that must have been something that you have talked to Caroline about, because, of course, it's an all-consuming role, isn't it? You've seen that from all the captains that you've played under or been vice-captain to.
Ryder Cup captaincy is there is a lot to it now. It's a much bigger deal than it was back in the day, you know, where I think captain was brought in near the end of it and given a, you know, pick a few players extra and you're out there. Now there's certainly 18 months of work going into it, and it's a job that can be done, obviously, if you don't have a partner or a wife there to help you, but it's a lot easier when you have somebody there, because, you know, it's not all about the golf being the captain of the Ryder Cup. There's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes, and a lot of things that, certainly in my case, I certainly don't relish having to pick the colours and the clothes we wear each day, and I don't relish, there's a lot of jobs. I'm very much interested in the golf, so, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that you would be better off having somebody very strong with you to help you out.
Are you worried how it could affect your golf game? I've heard you say that you want to be the oldest major winner, you want to win on the European Tour in your 50s. It's very hard to see a Ryder Cup captain who's actually performed at the top level.
Yeah, I do agree with you there. That the way I look at it is, yeah, I would like, in an ideal world, you would push it out. You'd be a Ryder Cup captain 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years, definitely after you finish playing. Ideally, you do it in Europe because you have a better chance of winning. There's so many reasons why you would push it, but that wouldn't be fair to the other players coming down the road. Would I get it in 5 or 6 years' time? It wouldn't be fair to the Ryder Cup in terms of, you know, going to the States next time. It sits well that I do that I would go and hopefully get the job, based on the fact that I have a strong profile in the States. It's not too far from Chicago, plenty of Irish. It's a good place for me to go. And I think if I opted out this time, it would definitely be a situation of, you know, maybe I don't deserve it down the road, because it would be a selfish decision if I didn't take it. It looks like the ideal time for the Ryder Cup, if they're ever going to have Patrick Harrington as a Ryder Cup captain, is 2020.
Brookline 1999, you're playing under Mark James. Paris, you've been vice captain to Thomas Bjorn, and lots of captains in between, don't need to mention them all. Who would you be most like
as Bernard a captain? Langer.
Bernard, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I've seen all the captains come through, and you know, you can go to your Woozies and Sam Tarnes's, which were big man management people who put their arm around your shoulder and tell you, I'm dropping you for a good reason. And, you know, and gave you that sense of belief. They were excellent in that, and great captains because of it. You know, I saw Mark James, we loved him in the team room. He did a few things that in hindsight, no captain will ever do again, which is interesting because, you know, he took one for the team. By not playing the rookies, it's a golden rule now, you've got to play your rookies. So, yeah, he was a great captain to the players and we enjoyed him, but, you know, it would have been a great win, but
what did so what did Bernard do that we, you know, where you would be comparable to then?
Bernard is somebody I would have admired as a player. I think he was the professionals player and got the most out of his game. I always tried to do the same thing, and you know, I look at the way he went about his Ryder Cup. You know, he'd be on the tee boxes telling people what clubs were hit, and I'm not saying he got involved, but I would want to give as much information to the players and stuff like that. Yeah, I just think I'd be more on that line. I will say, though, you know, since Monty in 2010, he gathered together what worked up to that and just tried not to do any of the stuff that didn't work. And, you know, it did put a bit of a template in place. Paul McGinley was, again, excellent. He also really had studied past Ryder Cups, put a lot of good stuff together, added a bit for sure, and Thomas followed it up, no doubt about it. We have a system in place that is pretty good, and if you look at the past way we've gone about it, you just want to stick to that. I'm not going to go into this Ryder Cup in any shape or form and reinvent it. I know I'm going to the States, I know it's a little tougher over there, but, you know, just try and use the good stuff that we've seen work in the past, and you know, avoid any of the mistakes that we've seen over the years, and there has been mistakes made, and avoid those, do the good stuff, and hopefully, you know, I'm not hit with anything that I can't handle.
Okay, so back to those people that are influential. Obviously Caroline's going to be a big part of the Ryder Cup. Bob Torrence.
Bob,
I mean, anyone who came across Bob Torrence, love the guy.
I don't think there's a day goes by that we don't talk about Bob Torrence out here on tour. It really is. All the time, the stories, so many things happen that remind you of Bob. And maybe it's just this time of the year, you know, being back in over here, that it comes up a bit more. I suppose when I'm in the States, not so. But yeah, I started working with Bob Torrence in 1998. I went to the US Open at the West Coast Olympic Club.
Yeah.
Played my best golf and finished 27th. So I realised, well, okay, this is my very best golf. I've got up and down everywhere I could get up and down for that week, and I finished 27th. Well, something's got to change. And I knew I couldn't improve my short game. So I said, right, who's the best swing coach out there? And it was a big difficult thing to leave my coach, Howard Bennett, who coached me since I'm 15 years of age, and move on. But I knew Bob Torrence. Every player who come to Bob Torrence was a ball striker, and that's what I didn't have. And that therein started my absolute obsession, really, with the golf swing and trying to make it better. And it was fantastic days with Bob. In some ways, I was his ideal pupil. He'd stand in the range for 12 hours, and I was quite happy to hit balls for 12 hours. But Bob was a psychologist. He was ahead of his time. He was the person I only knew Bob when he was an older man. Well into his 60s, at least. It felt like a very old man to me at that time. As I get older myself, he doesn't feel like he's an old man. But he was the guy I wanted to be at his age. I just always said, God, wouldn't I love to be like Bob Torrence when I'm 70 years of age? Like his humour and the way he lived his life. It was just great to be around.
Do you still, I've heard you say you still think.
All the time. All the time. Bob comes up all the time. I know I work with Pete Cowan now. Pete doesn't realise how much he's like Bob Torrence, so yeah.
But the things he would say as well, I mean, you know.
Bob would say fantastic. Like, when I started working with 1998, he was an alcoholic, so he'd stopped drinking for over a year. I obviously wouldn't have worked with him if he was. And one of the first tournaments, he came on the range, and he stands awfully close to you when you're practicing. So he stepped in and he caught his foot on the rope that's down on the range, and he tripped. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what's happening? He looks up at me. He didn't fall on the ground now. He just kind of tripped a little bit. He looks up at me and says, "Aye, there was a time I used to enjoy a good stumble." Like everything.
I thought you were going to do the voice as well.
Yeah, no,
you.
I can't do the voice. I started it, but yeah, but everybody has a story, and there's more and more stories, and there's even the same story told again is just brilliant. He just was a great person to be around. I don't think I could give him. The best compliment I could give him is says, "I'd love to be like him when I'm 70 years of age. I'd love to have his outlook." And he was a great coach. And I have to say, we parted ways. I was getting frustrated on the golf course, and Bob was just a little too old to be out in the golf course. And I was hitting it fine in the range and hitting it badly on the course. And that disconnect, and all of a sudden I went a different way. It's strange. I didn't really need to. It was so simple a fix. I wish I didn't need to change anything, as it turned out. But I just needed some other eyes on it. But Bob always said it, and he'd say it every day going to the range or going to the golf course. He'd shake your hand when you're leaving the range to go out in the first tee. Shake your hand and just say, "Happiest days of your life," and they truly were.
Yeah, no, wonderful man. The other Bob, who obviously played a big part, is Bob Rotella. Yeah. When did your relationship with him start?
So, I read his book, Golf Is Not a Game of Perfect, which was the first of his sports golf psychology books, and actually wasn't the first, but the first one of that series, and it's the Bible, if you ask me, for golf psychology. And I was so amazed by it. I played Madeira Island Classic, actually, where I was playing. I played like I was in the zone, like Muirfield, like Winged Foot, so much so that, as all good fellas do, I got my girlfriend at the time to ring him up and organise for a meeting. So I went to see him. I had to see the man in person. Went out and spent a couple of days in his basement, as you do, and I loved it. I was right into it. I will say, I suppose because I was playing so much in Europe, I didn't get to see him enough. I actually worked with a European guy, Josh Van Stipoff, for a long, long time, for 2 years in the middle there, 2-3 years. Interesting with Josh is his qualification to being a sports psychologist was, I think he had a top 20 in the Belgian pop charts. But he did a great job out there. But Josh really did. He a lot of success.
He saw a lot of players, didn't he? There was a lot.
Yeah,
of players.
A lot of guys. He was a European sports psychologist, and I suppose there wasn't a great deal around. But like, I remember he had Ernie Els and Thomas LeVay in the playoff of the Open in Muirfield in 2000, and two, and nearly had me in it. So sure. Like he had Michael Campbell. He was very successful and delivered a lot for me, I've got to say. But as soon as I got the opportunity to go back to Bob Rotella, when I started playing more in the States, I went back to Bob Rotella, and there was a reason for this, and it's about my makeup, I suppose. Josh did a lot for you, but he always did it for you. Whereas Bob Rotella is like a school teacher. He gives you your homework and it's up to you to do it. So Bob gives you the control, lets you go and do it, which is big for me. I always want to be in control. I wouldn't have a physio stretch me when I can do the stretches myself. You know, why would you have somebody else do something and then if he wasn't there, you're lost without him? You always got to have that control, that if left to survive on your own, you can survive in golfing terms. I can guarantee I wouldn't survive anywhere else. But yeah, for sure, that's with Bob, is brilliant that way. And I've worked with Bob since 1986, it's coming up to 20 years now. And it's been brilliant, the consistency, how solid he's being. You know, he doesn't change his story, and he gives it to you, and he'll check with you, he'll ask you, are you doing it? You know, really, are you committing to this? Are you getting it done? But, you know, he's not a snake oil salesman. He's not telling you what you want. Well, maybe he is telling you what you want to hear at times, but he's giving you practical help that it's up to you to do it day in, day out, and do it better.
But you've been with him seen him for such a long time. How can he still be teaching you?
Teaching me anything new. He doesn't change. That's the beauty of him. He doesn't come up and tell you something different. He tells you the same thing, sometimes in a different way, sometimes in a story. Sometimes, you know, he gives you a little story about somebody and, you know, he brushes it up and does it nicely. But it's the same thing. and it's up to you to do it. There's a consistency that way. If somebody keeps chopping and changing, he doesn't know what he's doing if he's telling you a different story. That was the same with Bob Torrance. Bob Torrance never changed his teaching. He was just so solid and consistent about how he went about things. You've no faith or trust in somebody who's flipping and flopping and moving around.
But that is so interesting, though, isn't it? Because you've talked about the two Bobs there and how they were so consistent in what they did.
Yeah.
You will always be looking to change something, you know, known as tinkering, looking for another way.
I know I get hung out, and that's certainly, yeah.
To improve, you feel, obviously.
I'm not trying to change. I'm trying to get the same thing all the time. I'm not really trying to change.
So why are you doing it differently then?
But I'm trying to get the same. I'm only trying to get one thing. So I'm not trying to, since 2005, probably the main thing in my golf swing I've been trying to get right is my hip turn. And I've just struggled with it. I couldn't ever get the concept of it. And a lot of the stuff I've done is on my footwork and all that to try and get my hips right. It's only this year I've actually figured it out. It's taken me that long. And with the consistency has been there, I can guarantee you can go to Pete Cowan right now, or you could go, if Bob was here, you could go to Bob, and they will tell you I'm the least fussy of all the guys when it comes to my swing in terms of, am I doing it? Yes. Do I need to do it more? Yes. No. Will this drill help me get it more? Yes. Okay, I'm fine. I'm off. I'm done. And I might... But see, I tell you what's happened, and this is my own fault. I don't want to practice at an event. Okay? What I mean by that is, as I explained to you earlier, I want to shut my brain down.
The process.
So, yeah. I don't... For example, if I turned around and... At the moment, I want to slow my takeaway down a little bit. I'm just snatch the club a bit, and I sway if I do that. So I have a drill, very simple drill. All the kids would know it. You put a golf ball behind your actual ball, and you drag the ball back. So I could stand there consciously and take the club away slowly. And by the way, folks, I really think it's a bad thing to swing your golf club slowly in the backswing. Okay, so if there's amateur golfers out there, the worst thing you can do for your golf swing is swing back slowly. It's really bad to keep your head down, and it's really bad to stay still. Okay, so those are terrible things to do. If you're listening to me, I'm not advocating taking a slow backswing, but sometimes I sway a bit. So I want to slow down. So I put a golf ball there, and I don't have to think of taking the club back slowly. The golf ball will help me do that. So I'm not using my left brain. I'm not being conscious about slowing down my backswing. Just in that area, I'm letting it happen with this drill. And over the years, I've had some funny drills to make me do things that I don't want to think about doing. I now realize, and if I was back, I would probably, you know, there's guys doing the same work I'm doing or worse. I would say a lot worse, because they're engaging their brain to do it, but they're not doing it where it looks any different. If you were sitting in the crowd watching them, you couldn't tell that they're doing consciously getting involved, whereas I was trying to unconsciously get involved, and unfortunately that leads to me look like I'm doing a lot of stuff that I'm not doing.
So it's an unfair reputation?
No. it's not an unfair reputation, but it certainly looks a lot worse than it actually is. Clearly, if I can hit the golf ball better, I'm prepared to do it. So there are other players who wouldn't prepare. Like, I have a two-piece takeaway at the moment to help me not sway off the ball. There's other players wouldn't do that, even if it made them better. Because it looks weird. I don't care. If I hit the ball better, I hit the ball better. And I don't have to think about it even better. So, yeah. The proof to me is how you hit the golf ball. And then the less you have to think about it, the better you're going to do it actually in competitive play.
And just to wrap up, here we are. We're sitting and chatting. And listen, I know you have to do this a lot, Baudric. And you're fascinating to listen to. I go back to one of the first memories I have of you. Sat at the Belfry, and you just pretty much blown about £150,000 because you hadn't signed a scorecard, and you were going to go into the final round of the tournament at the Belfry, five shots clear. And most players I know of, I'm not saying all players, but most players would have gone off in a huff and a puff, not to be seen again. You spent 2 hours in the media centre, talking to journalists, as I was then a national radio broadcaster, sitting down and talking it through patiently, going through it in detail. Where does that come from? And do you think it's important then to have that communication? Because you kind of have done it throughout your career.
Well, I've always had a good relationship with the media, because in Ireland, it's completely different. It was completely different. Since 15 years of age, I've been competing in amateur golf events, junior events. And after every junior round, after every event, you get interviewed. I would be on first name terms. I have the phone numbers of all the Irish media in my phone. I didn't have it at that age, because clearly I would have had their landline numbers right from that age. So I was schooled in talking to the media. Not schooled as in this is what you say or don't say, but I was comfortable with the media from a very early age, because there was a familiarity. And I do feel, I often talk this with the media, I find this really strange, but if you met a young pro, any young sportsman when he's turned pro, who has never had any interaction with the media, and say the golfer, he's led the event and he has to go in and do an interview, and if you got to talk to him before he went into the interview, he'd be saying he's scared doing that interview because he's afraid he's going to get stitched up. It's phenomenal that the fear that's endemic with these guys, where it's coming from, whether it's coming from their management or coming from, I don't know what it is. Like, the vast majority, and by and large, all the media, we're out here all working together. Everybody wants to write a good story. Nobody really wants to write a bad story. There's no such thing as bad news anyway. We all know that goes away and come, you know.
I know, but you've gone. I mean, to sit there, as I said, well, 2 hours my after brother, losing 150 odd.
My brother
like
pointed
that
out to me at the time. I straight away rang home on the landline, straight away, and I'll give you an interesting story actually, because I wanted to explain to my mum and dad that I'd been disqualified, but I'd done nothing wrong. That was huge deal for me. Now getting disqualified is like, you know, no, I've done nothing wrong. I'm disqualified. I shed a tear, but I didn't. I was so worried about, you know, quickly get to my parents so that they know it's okay. It's just disqualified. My wife, she rang her parents. Her parents told her sister, mm-hmm. who had no interest whatsoever in golf whatsoever, who mentioned it to her boyfriend, who was able to get onto Paddy Power's bookmakers and back the field against Padraig Harrington to win. So he backed everybody else against me, knowing that I was already gone. And they paid out too. Back in 2000. You were allowed to do that. Okay. Now we're not allowed to do any. But that just shows how a tip can go around. Like, I never talked to my in-law's sister, my wife's sister's boyfriend. He got news. It was a good half an hour after it happened, maybe. And he managed to get a bet on a 3-1 on the field. I think he got his maybe a 50 quid in it or something like that. And they paid him too. But there you go. That's what happens sometimes. That's why we're not allowed to give information, sure, and tips. You can understand why when you see something like that. But the biggest thing that happened that day was one of my brothers was there. I have a brother living in the UK and he was there watching it. And he came up to me straight away and he says, you know what? He says, this will be the first time somebody wins a tournament, but everybody will remember who didn't win the tournament. Mm-hmm. Whereas normally nobody remembers the second place or whatever. So he spun it in a different way that, you know, it's a big story. And the fact is, we're still talking about it 18 years later. So
I know, because that made an impression on me. Yeah. That's why.
But I was lucky, as I said, I was lucky that I could have gone off the rails thinking about all the bad stuff of losing. Whereas, as I said, I had somebody there, my brother. Maybe I would have come to this conclusion myself. I'd probably come to that conclusion now myself, but at the time, certainly having my brother there just to look at this a little bit different, to put a bit of lateral thinking on it and say, hey, you know, in the greater scheme of things, it's not the end of the world. You'll be remembered for this, you know, and not consciously, he wasn't saying consciously go out there and put a face in it, but, you know, there's no reason not to. It really is not the end of the world.
Like those three bogeys at Wingfoot turned out not to be the end of the world either.
Yeah, well, that could have been where, maybe that's where it started. But yeah, for sure, we do overread into a lot of things. And then that was one of those situations, Wingfoot being it too, where if you put the right spin on it, it can work in your favour. It's very important. I am definitely an optimist, but I work at it. I work at seeing things as being lucky, and I work at trying to be an optimist, because it really does help, you know. If you hit it in a divot down the first fairway, you can say, oh my God, I've hit it in a divot on the first hole of this tournament, this isn't going to be my week. Or you can walk down there and say, well, how lucky am I to hit it in a divot on the first hole and not the 72nd hole. And if you hit it in a divot on the 72nd hole, you can say, well, I really did want to hit a low shot in here, how lucky am I? You know, there's just so many ways of making stupid things out to be lucky. It's just all about what you think in your head, and golf is probably the greatest sport for that, because you can go out here this week, any week, and there'll be 156 guys on the range and it'll be hard to tell them apart. You go on the golf course and you'll tell them apart pretty quickly.
Well, that was great fun to sit with Padraig for that amount of time and to hear his thoughts. It was almost like a lesson in psychology, wasn't it, at times. Interesting, the round he chose, of course, not the obvious one that you might have expected, but he explains fully why that was the case. Love to hear your thoughts on him, the interview, him being the Ryder Cup captain. Please do get in touch with us. It'd be great to hear from you. You can do so on Twitter, at The Round Podcast, or on Facebook as well, at The Round Golf Podcast. And please do make sure you subscribe and maybe even give us a ratings on iTunes. Didn't realise from Series 1 how important that was. It'd be great if it's 5 stars. In fact, please do give us 5 stars. It'll help make the podcast a little bit more visible. People know that it is out there. Can't wait to bring you all the interviews that are coming up between now and the end of August. But thanks again to Padraig Harrington. And for now, bye-bye.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.